specialising in herbicide resistance. Starting in the late 1980s, we were working on nodding thistle and sheep pastures, and I've worked on most cases of herbicide resistance in New Zealand since then.
Great, thanks, Kerry. And next, Chris Budenhagen.
Hi, I'm Chris Budenhagen, and I work at Ag Research. I'm a weed ecologist and new to the herbicide resistance field, getting my feet wet quickly, and we're working with FAR to do herbicide resistance surveys in wheat and barley on the South Island. And I didn't mention this in my talk, but this year we're going to get Zach in, who's a technician here, to work on herbicide resistant in maize in the Waikato and Bay of Plenty and Gisborne. And that's another project that we're working on. So, but it's still with FAR. Yep. So cool. That's our main collaborator.
And John and Kai, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, John, farmer from Dorrie, or ex-farmer from Dorrie now on a lifestyle block just outside Ashburton. Did 40-plus years farming and battling weeds to various degrees of success.
Well, I'm Kai Teagle, so I've been in New Zealand since 89. Very much a background in agronomy with research farms, and just before we came off the farm, I was running a rolling company.
Great.
Gave that up.
Thanks, Kai and John. Now, Martin, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Georgia. My name is Martin Nesbick. I'm a social scientist at Ag Research in Lincoln, just outside of Christchurch. I work in the farm systems and environment team. And like Chris, I jumped in the deep end with herbicide resistance and didn't only get my feet wet. Quite deep waters there. But I've been with Ag Research for a bit over a year now and really enjoying the work in the herbicide resistance project with Robin Dines.
Great. Robin.
Thanks, Georgia. Robin Dines. I'm a farm system scientist with Ag Research, along with Martin, based at Lincoln a long time ago. I grew up on a mixed cropping farm in central Canterbury, and my role has been working with Martin in, as part of the interviews, bringing a farm systems perspective alongside Martin's social science.
Great. So now everyone's got an idea of the different kind of expertise and skills that have been working on the herbicide resistance project, and also in John and Kai's case, are out there arable farming. I'd really like to invite now each of the speakers to go through and give us a quick synopsis of what they talked about in our podcast. Key learnings, messages that we should all take away from those discussions. So again, in order of the podcast publications, I'd like to invite Kerry to go first.
Very good, thank you. Within my podcast, I just introduced the whole concept of herbicide resistance and reminded people that it's due to a build-up of individuals. You get individuals within weed populations, might be one in a million, one in a billion, that have a mutation that mean that they're not killed by a herbicide. Which they're not a problem unless you keep applying that herbicide time after time, in which case they start to build up and they cause problems. But that's different from herbicide tolerance, where there are a number of weeds that have herbicide tolerance. They are ones that were never controlled by the herbicide in the first place. And the example I mentioned was white clover, which a lot of people know is not controlled well by glyphosate. But if you get a buildup of herbicide-tolerant weeds, it usually means that you may be on the way to getting herbicide resistance. So usually that's a sign that things are going badly. If you're getting a buildup of tolerant weeds, you may be selecting for these mutants that can build up to the extent that the herbicide is no longer effective on weeds that used to be taken out by that herbicide. So I discussed those concepts, and I also mentioned that we've developed a number of strategies over time to develop work with herbicide resistance, and there are links to these strategies at the bottom of the web page, within LandWise with my podcast, or you can Google them up by going NZPPS herbicide resistance. And then I went through and talked about some of the stuff that we're doing at Massey University. One of the things we're trying to do is come up with quick tests. At the moment, we can test for herbicide resistance, but it means growing things in pots and then waiting until they're big enough and then spraying them and then waiting for a few weeks to see whether they die or not. Sort of stuff that Chris has been doing recently and we did before him. But it takes a long time, a lot of glass house space. It can be quite expensive if you cost it out. Whereas we're looking at quicker ways of doing it. Some of those are looking at genes, being able to pick up the DNA sequences that are involved with some of these mutations. And so that could be done quickly. Another type of quick test is looking at seeds, looking at whether we just germinate the seeds, expose them to herbicides, and see whether they have resistance or not. So we're just fine-tuning all that. Then hopefully within the next year or so, we'll be able to offer those tests so you can find out whether you've got resistance or not within a few days rather than have to wait a month or so. So that's just quickly summing up what I was talking about.
Great. Thank you, Kerry. Yeah, I think that's a really good summary of everything, and great to see that you've got so many resources available on that New Zealand Plant Protection website as well. Now I'd like to invite Chris to talk about some of the work that he's been doing around the herbicide resistance survey and assessing the risk of herbicide resistance development.
Right, so we have been working with FAR on the South Island and looking at resistance in mid Canterbury and South Canterbury, and the resistance level mostly in ryegrass and oats has been about 20 to 50% of the farms have some resistance cases being detected. That is to say, our people have gone out with the interns at FAR have gone out to collect survivors close to harvest time and sent us seeds, and we've tested the seed by growing it out and, like Kerry described, and spraying it with a variety of herbicides, and the resistance has mostly been to group A or B herbicides, which is expected given the situation worldwide. And we've also done a risk assessment with respect to all the possible weeds that have been recorded in wheat and barley fields, and discussed how often they've developed resistance overseas. And the top 10 weeds, are three quarters of them are grasses, and so grass weeds are definitely more prone to developing resistance, and that would be the main point.
Great, thank you, Chris. Yeah, I'm sure we'll have some great opportunities to kind of cross question you a bit later. So next I'd just like to invite John and Kai to talk about some of their experiences with arable farming and how they've managed weed control in a complex vegetable seed rotation and other arable crops.
Yeah, well, I don't think we've come across any resistance, but I've certainly got tolerance. Over the years, I've noticed that the problem weed spectrum has changed depending on the main base herbicide used in the cereal grass situation. And then when we started growing more vegetable seeds, we had other weeds that were definitely tolerant to the herbicides in those crops, which they became problem weeds. But we used initially pasture phase to help control the weeds, you know, and then latterly sort of a capital herbicides program to control the problem weeds in our other crops. They weren't a problem in the crop, but we made sure that we had them controlled. And the backstop was, well, we just got them down to a manageable level, but we used all sorts of inter-row cultivation. Kai did a lot of work roguing, so did I. So that was, we used all the tools in the toolbox the best we could.
Great, thank you guys. Yeah, that's definitely a common theme that we're hearing, that it's really important to maintain the efficacy of all of those different methods of weed control, to have a kind of variety of tools, as you say, to deal with weeds and make the best decisions possible. So following on from that, Martin, would you like to sum up what you and, well, firstly, what your part of the podcast discussion was about the other day?
Sure. Thanks, Georgia. So we've been working on the drivers for herbicide use and some of the drivers behind those practices then leading to herbicide resistance. We've mainly worked with arable farmers in mid-Canterbury. Some of them had identified resistance through the FAR survey, conducted interviews and focus groups with them, rural professionals in the area, also weed scientists. And we really looked into that complex decision-making environment behind on-farm decision-making. And what we were quite surprised by was just the sheer number of voices that sit behind farmers' decisions. Think about up to half a dozen agronomists giving advice on specific crops, independent farm advisors, and so forth. And then approaching the question of herbicide practices through a farm system lens or perspective, what we elaborated on in the podcast is just really diverse elements and drivers that come in terms of practice change. So it's not only information and knowledge transfer, but there's a lot of other aspects or drivers that come in for practice change. And we elaborated a little bit on the strategic decision making in terms of good record keeping, and then importantly to act on those records and go back to them. Elaborated on what might support growers and rural professionals in their strategic decision making around herbicide use.
Great, thank you, Martin. Yeah, it was a really good, insight into how a social science study works around something as complex as herbicide use and resistance development. So, Robin, you've come from more the biophysical side, but now you're involved in social science. Can you talk a bit about your involvement with this project and what you're finding?
Yeah, thanks, Georgia. And look, Martin has done a really good summary of what we've done. And I guess where I have been providing insights is just the capacity to really drill down with the farmers and understand a little more about their decision making. And this is Martin's first opportunity to work with New Zealand farmers, and he's really embraced it. And that's fantastic. But the challenge I keep putting back to Martin is, so how do we make a difference in this program? How do we come up with insights about where there are gaps that could make a real difference to this journey of farmers keeping all of their tools available to them, exactly as John and Kai just discussed? And I think New Zealand farmers, you know, we know we've got a lot of tools in the toolbox, and we are maybe cruising along a little bit with those tools in the toolbox. And many good farmers are encountering, exactly as John and Kai said, some challenges coming their way. I was astounded that farmers clearly have got a lot better memories than me, because many of them were very reliant on remembering what they'd done in a paddock previously. And you know, the opportunity I see for other supports, making it easier for them to act, readily be able to see their data on the run, on the move, are real opportunities for technology going forward. Most of all, it was the things that we already knew, the complexity of the decision making, the number of factors that have to be weighed up, and generally the excellence and approach that many farmers are bringing to what they're doing. So within that, you know, the challenge for Martin and I are, where are those gaps? Where are the vulnerabilities? What kind of information might make a difference? So it's been fantastic, Georgia, as you can imagine, the information and the learnings that we've had and the challenges we've been able to give the farmers, and trying to explore things like the trade-off between a low emissions economy and ploughing in the toolbox. We've had brilliant answers and it's been really good. Right. But I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. That's a really great support to what Martin was talking about, and helps kind of flesh out this quite complex and varied discussion. So if I could, I guess, follow on from one of your final points there about record keeping and how farmers are often running around with lots of things in their head and relying on a good memory to keep all of those weed management practices recorded. John and Kai, you've used production-wise in the past. Can you elaborate a little bit on how you've found that to work within your farm system?
Yes, it's good. It's entered it in. Now is the environmental things, and we need to do the farm environment plan. It's worked in quite well that, but it's been long. I've been recording long term what I've done on the different paddocks, and not down necessarily to the level of the group of chemical, but I do understand and can find out what I've used on each paddock and each crop over the years. And I do go back and see what I've used and endeavour the best I can not to use the same chemicals year after year, but it does become very difficult at times. But yeah, definitely record keeping, and it's going back to check what you have done before is the important bit, which we don't always do. But as Robin said, we've got good memories because we've been running around out in the field, and a lot of the decisions are made more on gut feeling. I feel, you know, this is a weed spectrum we've got. Well, this has worked. Okay, let's go with that, and because we know it worked.
Well, I think one of the challenges for farmers is that, you know, what Martin was saying before, there's 6-7 people sitting behind you saying, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do that. And sometimes, we're lucky John is quite knowledgeable about chemicals. Not everybody is. And can thereby give you some anti-guess. I'll say, you know, push back a bit. I'm not going to use that because it's either it's not going to do that, or, you know, it's the wrong group or something like that. But you know sometimes you have reps that won't let you do that. They say no, you got to use this. And how do you get past that?
And it's quite often it comes not from the local company, but from the overseas company. Mm-hmm. This is how we do it in wherever, and we want you to do it like this because it works, but they don't consider what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Robin, you've got your hand up. Would you like to comment on anything?
Thanks. And interestingly, I think, John and Kai, the maximum number of specialist agronomists on one farm we interviewed was 6. We found that most farmers felt that they had excellent support from these agronomists coming in with individual contracts, but they felt very much the long-term viability of the tools in their toolbox, including chemicals, very much rested with them, except those farmers that had long-term relationships with their own farm consultant. And depending on the farm consultant, they knew that they had a team there. And farmers had a range of tools for deciding who was their trusted person. And we did see the culture of some of the companies to be really strong around both education and the willingness for the farmer to talk to people further up the ranks if they wanted to. Martin, is that fair? You're muted, Martin, but that's, farmers were quite sophisticated in how they made their decisions, surrounded by so many people giving them advice.
Absolutely, and I think we heard from a lot of the farmers that we spoke with that they have a good sense of whether an agronomist who comes on farm has the crop in mind, or also the long-term relationship with the farmer. So this is where, you know, your trust meter comes in, I think, as a landholder, and this was quite clear, I think, in most of the interviews that came up.
Okay, great. Chris, would you like to comment perhaps on the strategies, I guess, to avoid herbicide resistance? We were talking a little bit about rotating those modes of action and also spacing out modes of action and mixing herbicides.
Mm-hmm. So this is mostly me commenting on other people's work and reflecting it in my work. So I'll just make that comment as a caveat. Overseas work with rigid ryegrass and modeling efforts showed that the use of pre-emergence and trifluralin in particular for ryegrass seed control was particularly effective when mixed with the other modes of action as well. So, and spacing things out more than a year or two in terms of using the same mode of action helps. And mixing herbicides helps too, because the probability of getting a single mutation for one mode of action is a lot higher than the probability of getting the same, getting a mutation for two modes of action. So basically you're dealing with a probabilities issue, and if you can mix herbicides in a single year, you're more likely to get, if it might, it might be resistant to a group A but not to glyphosate or something like that, as an example. So the spacing out is really important. The use of pre-emergent seems to be strategic in these modeling exercises they've done overseas, and the mixing helps. So that's kind of, it's not complicated, but it is actually harder when you consider there's only a few modes of action normally available.
Actually. Yeah. So would you like to add anything to that, Kerry?
I think he's got it fairly well covered. And it's one of the things that we discuss in those strategies I was talking about. So we do have a strategy on the NZPPS site about what to do in cereal crops, and just looking at the various modes of action, including the trifluralin that that Chris mentioned there. But also we've got strategies, although this has been mainly talking about arable cropping, I'm mindful of the fact that it's not just arable cropping people are listening into this, so we've also got strategies there for vineyards, which we've had major problems with, the glyphosate resistance with ryegrass, and we think that's starting to come through in pit fruit now as well. So we just need to watch out for that, and looking at bringing in residual herbicides now, or pre-emergent herbicides, to try and help with that. But also in the pasture situation, which is where I started out, and major problems with nodding thistle initially, and now giant buttercup resistant to MCPA initially, and now also resistant to flumetulam. So it's just a matter of looking at strategies in each of those situations. It's not necessarily always about herbicide rotation. It's also looking at other strategies, especially in pastures. We can use pasture management strategies to, so that you're not overusing the herbicides.
Right. So there's potentially more options when livestock are involved in a pasture scenario than potentially with arable.
Yeah, though with arable cropping, I mean, there is the possibility of cultivating every once in a while just to bury the seeds that are starting to build up on the surface. A lot of use of direct drilling nowadays, and I think that has resulted in more rapid evolution of herbicide resistance, especially with grass weeds. But also just using crop competitions, getting the crop established rapidly and trying to outcompete any weeds that might be in there.
Right, great. And I think I'm just recalling a comment that you made, John and Kai, about the potential for livestock to spread weed seed around, and how to think about that when you have a mixed cropping rotation, including livestock.
Yeah, that's in my roguing experience, I came across someone who had been really good. Cleaning up a paddock after harvesting a brassica early in the season, cleaning out the header in the yard, and you so that you wouldn't spread all the seed around his farm. And then 3 months later, he wanted to clean up a paddock that was going to go into brassica, but a different sort of brassica. And then thought, I'll clean the sheep out in the yard so that they don't take seed from any of the other paddocks with it into that paddock. And they ate all the seed that was in the yard that he got out of the header. And he had forgotten about that. So that was just an example that, you know, you got to do something. And you got to really remember what you'd done even 3 months earlier. It's tricky.
You mentioned as well, John, that some people keen to get a really good tilth for the crop would do a stale seed bed and get rid of weeds that way, but if they're not doing it on that long term, that can potentially bring up a lot of buried weed seeds.
Yes. My experience is long term stale seed bed is the best way. If you cultivate close to planting, you're going to get a whole new strike of weeds. I found even now when I'd strip tilled after winter feeding oats to cattle, there was a lot less weed issues in my vegetable seeds because the area of land disturbed was less. You don't want to get in there too late doing your big cultivation because you need that long term. Seed can stay buried for 50 years and still come up.
Yep. Okay, great. So trying to reduce the disturbance and therefore reduce the weed re-emergence.
Yes.
So I guess that kind of leads into what you were talking about, I believe, Robin, in our chat, that advice needs to be integrated within the farm system and, farm advisors and people talking about herbicide resistance can't just think about the weed side of things. It's got to be connected to all other parts of the business.
Look, I think what we saw, and Martin, please come in. What we did see with it, that farmers generally had the long-term goal in mind. So they might be getting herbicide, they might be getting agronomists coming in to talk about a particular crop that they had the contract for. But the farmer was very good at understanding their system and the role of livestock in their system or not. And the tools that they were readily, the tools that I guess were at the top of their toolbox. And, John, not every farmer used stale seed beds, but quite a few of them did. And some who had experienced particular issues with weeds had they had it figured out, but they did see that they were responsible for that integration. Although those that had their own farm consultant did note that in their farm consultant, they had that other person to bounce ideas off and that other person who also had that long-term goal. So farmers are used to keeping all of those balls in the air, and most of them that we interviewed seemed pretty comfortable they had that under control, pretty comfortable that they had the trusted people that they could seek input from, but they backed their own decisions. Martin, did I miss anything?
No, I think that's a really good summary. I mean, what I might add is that in terms of juggling all these responsibilities and keeping balls in the air, I think it's not surprising that if herbicide resistance isn't yet an immediate issue in the area or on farm, that may not sit within top three priorities at the moment. So the challenge, I think, for us as a team is to find ways to propose some proactive strategies that can easily be implemented without distracting from some of these other priorities. I see that Kai might have a comment on that.
Yeah, no, I'd just like to comment that the problem that we're getting at the moment now is that we're getting weeds that we can't do anything with anymore. And I'm not talking about super weeds. I'm just talking about what I've seen when I was roving, that, for example, things like mallow and I'm not talking about the one in the fodder bag that came in the seed, but I'm just talking about normal mallow and cleavers. Man, it's a battle. We just haven't got the chemicals, or we haven't got we haven't got the tools to do something with them. And 5-6 consultants on the back of that doesn't help. It's a problem.
And it's an interesting point, Kai, and I think we have not, it's always an issue, we haven't interviewed enough farmers to pick up enough of those issues. We've picked up some specific issues, and in those cases, some of the farmers were looking to overseas to find strategies that have been trialled overseas, and they were certainly getting others involved and helping them figure out on what approaches might be. Sometimes that was a neighbour, sometimes it was someone else they knew that had encountered that, sometimes it was going to some of the very senior people who've been around a long time in the agencies that they worked with. But often they were perhaps a little more tactical in their thinking and perhaps a little less strategic, but we need Martin to finish analysing all the interviews. I mean, I don't know what he's been doing for the last 3 weeks, for heaven's sake. we need to start to see how many of those patterns fall out, because it's easy to talk about the ones that are on top of your head. And, you know, maybe we need to go and target some other farmers who are dealing with specific weeds, Martin, in the next generation of our interviews.
Yep, really good feedback and will help us going forward.
Cool. I might ask Chris to expand a little bit more about the relative resistance risk work that you were doing. And I think one of the surprising things that came out of that was just how many grass species there were in the top 10 kind of risk factors for resistance developing and resistance to different modes of action.
Well, it's actually a worldwide situation that grasses are more prone to developing resistance, and it has to do probably with how often that seed is in the seed bank. That's probably the simplest answer. So grass seed, the more seeds you have in the seed bank that come up every year, the more chances you have to select for that rare mutant. But there is also some evidence that recombination rates and mutation rates are higher in grasses on average. And that's a genomic characteristic. And then if you also have outcrossing on a grass species or any crop, outcrossing increases your probability of getting more of the genes spreading from one plant to another as well. So there's a few different reasons why that might be.
Kerry, you've got a comment?
Yeah, well, another point to keep in mind is grasses as a whole tend to have shorter life for their seeds in the soil, so they don't last anywhere near as long, which means if you've got susceptible versus resistance, you can get rid of the susceptible individuals more rapidly than if it's a broadleaf species. And so that can be another thing that allows resistance to build up more rapidly to grasses. Having said that, though, if you look at all the cases of resistance we have in New Zealand, a lot of them aren't grasses to date. All the problems with the thistles and fat hen and all the rest of it. And I think that exercise with Chris was mainly in wheat, which is where it's quite difficult to try and get rid of grasses selectively within a grass crop, where you really do only have a limited number of herbicides available to you. But yeah, certainly it's something to watch out for.
Great. And Kerry, you're probably the best person to answer this, having had a lot of experience in the weed science area and following resistance development for so many years. How do you think growers are viewing herbicide resistance now versus 20 years ago?
I think a lot of it comes down to how much publicity there is around, and certainly FAR's been doing a good job making sure that the message is getting out there. But also it depends on each of the different situations. There was a lot of publicity within the vineyard industry not so long ago when the first cases of glyphosate resistance turned up there. And prior to that, in the dairy industry, when we had the giant buttercup problem. So depending on where the problems are. But I think a lot of New Zealanders are aware of the major problems herbicide resistance causing in Australia. So Australia's not that far away, but also in the US. And so at the moment, New Zealand isn't as bad as a lot of these overseas countries as far as herbicide resistance is concerned, partly because we're able to do more flexible crop rotations than perhaps in Australia. But it is something that is increasing in New Zealand. So we're getting more cases and as a result, more publicity. And I think farmers are becoming more aware of it as a result.
And looking for those resistance cases on a systematic basis, Chris, has probably helped with that as opposed to the ad hoc sort of basis it's been until now?
Yeah, I think there's before we did any systematic work, I think that you had to have quite a few steps between the farmer and the scientist, and there's only a few scientists in New Zealand who can work on this. So All of those things had to come together, and I think often people had some solution for the problem, and it probably never even went past that initial, oh, something going on here, and then they had another chemistry to try, so it never got past that initial detection. And so this, we're kind of lowering the threshold for farmers by going out and just looking for it without any other criteria other than that it's surviving whatever treatment's out there. So it's probably a little bit unfair to call it ad hoc because there's a lot of science involved and a lot of careful thinking involved. But now, you know, with this step, we're lowering that threshold. A lot of these people who we got seed from and plants from in the random surveys, they weren't recognizing a particular problem. So we're detecting some of those when it's not a severe problem.
Robin, did you have a question or a comment?
I've actually got a question for Kerry. Kerry, one of the things that came through very strongly because we were interviewing in Central Canterbury was that grass seed crops were the dominant high-value contract that many of these farmers had. And so there was a bit of a sensitivity based on Chris's work to the risk that they faced because of their reliance on grass seed crops and the value of them to the profitability of their businesses. So how do you weigh that up, Kerry? You know, we know they're higher risk. Are we thinking strategically enough in these farming businesses given the profitability of that particular crop?
Well, I think a lot of the issues come down to money. A lot of the times with farmers, it comes down to the herbicides that are used. Generally, farmers will use the cheapest, most effective herbicide, and they tend to use it time and time again because it works well, which is why you get resistance. But likewise, the crops that are grown, it's all very well saying use good crop rotation and go back in the pasture for 10 years. But if you're not making much of a profit doing that, which is something that John mentioned in his podcast, as a result, you've got financial pressure on you to grow the crops that are producing the best revenue for you. And if that happens to be ryegrass seed crops, and ryegrass seed crops are leaving a lot of ryegrass seed back in the soil, which then go on to cause problems in the future. But at the end of the day, that's what earns them the most money, and it keeps the bank manager away when you're trying to pay your loans.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that will be interesting, Kerry, is when Martin finishes his analysis of the interviews, because some of our farmers were definitely, I want the cheapest option. But a significant number of our farmers, Martin, from memory, were, I want the best option for the tactical option for the crop today and the strategic one into the future. Some said, I'm going to look at what that crop's worth and I'm going to decide how much I'm prepared to spend on it. A lot said, actually, I want the best for the job today as well for the future. So be interesting, Martin, when you tease that apart. Hopefully, Kerry, many are taking the wisest possible approach.
Yeah, and I guess one of the issues is herbicide resistance isn't a major problem at the moment compared with Australia, where they just can't farm in a lot of places anymore because none of their herbicides work, and also because they're on such a low profit margin over there that if they can't use the cheapest herbicide, they can't grow the crop, they can't make a profit. So they are forced into using just one or two herbicides and they run into major problems. Fortunately, in New Zealand, we're not in that situation at the moment, and there are other drivers that make farms have various decisions that they do. But I think it's once the resistant weeds get out of control that farms think, oh, we better do something about it. But really, tactically, it's better not to get in that situation. And so if you can avoid the resistance occurring in the first place.
And Kerry, that's exactly what I've been challenging Martin with, because I was working in Western Australia in livestock in the days when all of those wheat belt farmers got rid of the sheep. Much to my disgust, they were known as white lice. And, I would never sit here now and say, I told you so. But all of the experts, the Chris's, all of those people like yourself were standing up saying, whoa, 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 this is not going to end well. And in that environment, it didn't take long, did it?
No.
Profit drivers, white lice, large hectares. It was an easy option, but it did not turn out to be a long-term option.
Thanks, well, Robin. I was just going to open up the chat to anyone listening, to our guests. If you'd like to ask a question, feel free to turn on your mic and ask away, or send one through to the meeting chat and we'll ask one of the panelists. But carry on, Martin.
Now, to follow up on what Carrie mentioned in terms of experiences overseas where we already see resistance, I think there's a really good opportunity for New Zealand too and New Zealand farmers to look at some of those experiences and learnings from overseas and see what do they mean for New Zealand. Do we have to get ourselves in a position where we face similar problems, or can we proactively, at least to some degree, learn from what's happening overseas and prevent something similar here, to really, as Robin said in our podcast, keep all those tools in the toolbox for the long term.
Great. Thanks, Martin. Any questions coming through? Dan, do you have any comments you'd like to ask? I mean, add, or questions to ask?
No, not really at this stage, Georgia. I think the key thing is this idea of integrated weed management, really, and you're using all the tools and you can't take your foot off the brake or the accelerator, whichever one you're using to stop this thing. But just echoing the conversation about Australia, I spend a bit of time in Australia off and on, and the message that I constantly get back from Australian farmers, you Kiwis haven't got much in the way of herbicide resistance. For God's sake, make sure you don't get it, because we've got it and you do not want that. So they really stress keeping it out rather than trying to get rid of it afterwards. There's a current biosecurity issue that we've got on, which is very, very parallel to that, that we're doing quite well on as a nation of 5 million people. So perhaps we can take these lessons from our human pandemic stuff and apply it back to our cropping as well, because these things are a hell of a lot hard to get rid of when they get away on you than when, if you can stomp on it at the time.
Great. Thanks, Dan. Anyone else got final questions to ask or comments to add? No? Okay, cool. Well, thank you all very much for your time, panellists and guests today. It's been great to have you on and summarise what we've talked about this month about managing herbicide resistance. And, yeah, I guess just have the opportunity to question you a bit further, and I'm sure we will keep up with your research, and of course we'll keep up with you, John and Kai, as part of the Lambwise community. So yeah, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.